You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you made a speech, a very important, long speech, and at the end of it, I praised your speech as having solidity. I think you might correctly read that as, at best, a backhanded compliment. And so it was with Charles Evans Hughes's acceptance speech at Carnegie Hall in New York City, taking the nomination of the Republican Party and then reading the reaction in the Springfield Republican newspaper, which is supposed to be on the GOP side. And that's how they described the speech. They also said it had heaviness. Oh no, please, Springfield Republican, no more compliments like that. But the paper went on. Hughes's speech had no display of flightiness. Oh God, you are crushing me with your compliments. President of Harvard, Elliott, also joins in. He says Hughes' speech is lacking in exact measures. What would he do in the war? We don't know. We know with some precision what President Wilson would do. Most of the Republican partisan press was very supportive about Hughes' speaking. Maybe just supportive enough. Nobody seemed exhilarated. One critique came from Theodore Roosevelt, who told Charles Evans Hughes directly, "You have to speak like a poster. You have to be clear, concise." He would go out there and say, "Wilson doesn't speak softly and carry a big stick. He speaks strongly and carries a dish rag. You have to speak like a poster," he told Hughes. "Not an etching." Roosevelt was referring to those newspaper illustrations at the time that would have been made in relief with every little detail covered. I mean, they're beautiful things. But he felt Hughes's speeches were like that, just describing everything and losing all of the emotion. But that's easy for Roosevelt to say. Roosevelt had a strong position on the European conflict. And Hughes, who still was hoping for the backing of some of those German language newspapers and German Americans, millions of them across America, who were tired of Wilson, who kept talking about Americans with hyphenated nationalities that he didn't like, or Roosevelt complaining about disloyal Americans, or mollycots, as he called them, that caused him to lose the Republican nomination. Their only vote was going to be with Hughes. So he had to keep them in line. He couldn't go too far in that. Even when he said in his speech that we should be firm, paper still asks, what does firm mean? Does this mean if the Germans take a shot at a British ship that has Americans on it, we go to war? Or what? Nobody knew. And Hughes wasn't going to say, not at least till after November. The ones that had a true poster, a simple message in this campaign, was the Democrats. Those supporting Woodrow Wilson. And his simple message was, he kept us out of war. We talked about that in the last episode. Both Roosevelt and Hughes think that that slogan is disgusting. Roosevelt calls it cowardly. And Hughes questions it. We have intermittent peace at best, and it's unstable. What was Mexico? In some ways, Woodrow Wilson shared in their views. When confronted with the convention platform from St. Louis, he kept us out of war. Wilson was aghast. He hadn't asked for that. He told his Navy Secretary, Josephus Daniels, "They talk about me as if I were a god. I can't keep the country out of war. Any little German lieutenant can put us into war at any time by some calculated outrage. So Wilson had a poster, but he wanted an etching. He wanted to explain the nuances of policy. Hughes gave them an etching and not a poster. And one thing that he liked to talk about quite a lot was the tariff, because there he could draw a direct line between Wilson's party, which was low tariffs. In fact, Wilson had reduced tariffs during the first term of his presidency. And high tariffs, generally speaking, united the Republican Party. Tariffs protective of industries. If it went too far, you might lose some of the progressives. They also didn't like the tariff lobby, the progressives, because that's the same business people that were fighting on other fronts. But generally, high tariffs united Republicans. Theodore Roosevelt is going to be generally a high tariff guy. So is William Howard Taft. So is Abraham Lincoln. You get it? So is James Garfield. You get it? Tariffs. So it's easy to talk about tariffs, but it's kind of like talking about oatmeal. It's good for you, but it doesn't really excite people that much. Speech is flat. That's what Tumulty tells Woodrow Wilson and Colonel Edwin House, Wilson's confidential aide who held no official role in the federal government except to be in Wilson's ear. Wilson's good friend. He came from a rich family in Texas. The man had elected four governors of Texas. One of them was so grateful that he gave him an honorary militia title of colonel, even though House had never fired a shot. But House was ready to go to battle in this contest. In fact, at times, he seemed more enthused about re-electing Wilson than President Wilson did. And he had a very simple plan. I think we can show Hughes is not a true progressive. House knew something else. The Republicans, with their pro-tariff position, had a lot of money. Wilson's only chance was going to be to get the Republicans to spend that in the East on newspaper ads, on speakers' bureaus, pamphlets and handouts, winning those more expensive Eastern states, and to, in fact, sort of cede the East to the Hughes campaign and go out west, and with the South and the West, win. It's not as easy as House thought. Wilson wouldn't agree with everything that House said, especially House wants Wilson to answer every charge in the newspaper using what he has, the presidential pulpit. Wilson isn't going to do that. In fact, Wilson is going to make just a few speeches during the campaign. He will go out. He'll go as far as Nebraska. He will go to Kentucky, though he'll only speak in Kentucky, at Lincoln's log cabin about Abraham Lincoln. He won't say a word about Hughes or Woodrow Wilson, for that matter. No, mostly they can't get Wilson very far from his summer home in the Jersey Shore. Wilson had rented a summer house because it had a huge lawn with this wonderful porch with these columns that just almost looked like the White House. It was called Shadow Lawn. And it would be Wilson's weapon in this war because House and others felt couldn't speak from the White House on partisan matters. But Wilson could go up to Elberon and speak there at Shadow Lawn. He'd never do as much speaking as they wanted. But what he did counted, as we'll talk about. For those who could see it, like Colonel House, the battle in 1916 was for the Bull Moose progressives. These are the people that bolted the party along with Theodore Roosevelt in 1912, that went along with him. And even though House had a very simple plan and thought maybe the Republicans would take the bait, they didn't exactly. It's not like the Republicans ceded the West or ceded progressives to the Wilson campaign. In fact, they have a powerful weapon, and one of them, and they have speakers, notably Gifford Pinchot. Now, Gifford Pinchot would have been a pretty big superstar in the progressive or Bull Moose movement, a supporter of Roosevelt. He's the guy who got fired by Taft and is one of the reasons, after Roosevelt comes back from a safari, that he decides to run for president and take it away from Taft and starts the whole problem in 1912. So Gifford Pinchot is kind of like the Joan of Arc of the progressive movement, and he comes out with a pamphlet saying he's for Hughes, and here's all the reasons that progressives need to support Hughes. That's pretty a powerful weapon. Now, others, more behind the scenes, other Republican progressives who had supported Roosevelt in 1912 are having a little bit more difficulty. You take Albert Beveridge, Indiana senator and key supporter of Roosevelt. Years later, he's going to say he had a lot of trouble trying to make a speech. Why would I argue against Woodrow Wilson? Even though I'm a Republican senator, he's passed everything we wanted. A Federal Reserve, a Federal Trade Commission, currency reform, child labor. And he stood up to the most excessive tariff lobby. I mean, I'll do it, but clearly it's not a simple matter, Beveridge says, to frame a militant campaign against an administration with such a progressive record. Hiram Johnson in California says, I do a supporter quietly. I don't see why we have to come out with great force for Hughes here. But to be clear, he also says, I have no problem with Hughes and no problem with progressives aligning with Hughes. So you have some discontent in progressive ranks. But some of this is going to come out after the election. Publicly, they're behind Hughes. This is quite a powerful weapon to have the stand pat conservatives and the progressives of the most powerful political party in the country, really the majority party, the grand old party in the country at this time, united. This is a crazy election in many ways, and it's going to come down to a lot of different groups and how they interpret things, because it can't just be as simple as some of the things you read in a textbook, even though there's some truth there. Like Wilson, he kept us out of war. Yeah, that's true, but there's certain groups who are going to react differently to that. For instance, take the German language newspapers. When they see that slogan, Wilson, he kept us out of war, I just imagine today's social media in the comments section, and it's going to be like, yeah, okay, what's all these munition factories all across America? Why are we shipping arms to Britain? How come we haven't complained about Britain's violation of German rights on the high seas? Socialists feel the exact same way. Eugene Debs is campaigning for that congressional seat in Indiana, and he's going to say, Wilson doesn't care about the growing arms industry in America because it helps Wall Street. That's all he cares about. So just because the Democrats are out there saying he kept us out of war, just remember, it's a pitch, and not everybody buys that pitch. A crazy year that we're talking about. So much is going on. There are shark attacks, which are unusual for the parts of the country where they occur in. At least one shark attacks five swimmers along 80 miles of New Jersey coastline, resulting in four deaths. This event from 1916 is going to be the inspiration for 50 years later, author Peter Benchley to write Jaws. In Seattle, 1916, William Boeing incorporates Pacific Aerial Products into the company that will later take his name. German agents, well aware, though America is a neutral country, there's munitions factories here, and they orchestrate a sabotage, a huge explosion in Jersey City called the Black Tom Explosion. The explosion was the equivalent of 50 tons of TNT. It traveled an incredible speed of 24,000 feet per second and caused immense damage. They hear it all over New York City. There are fragments of the Black Tom explosion embedded in the Statue of Liberty and in the clock tower in the Jersey Journal building, a significant landmark in that area. It's felt as far as Philadelphia. It necessitates evacuation of all immigrants being processed at the time at Ellis Island. The German government will forswear any knowledge of it. In the same year, the first true self-service grocery store, the Piggly Wiggly, is founded in Memphis by Clarence Sanders. D.W. Griffith's 3.5-hour movie, Intolerance, with 4 parallel storylines, Love's Struggle Through the Ages, is released in the United States. John D. Rockefeller becomes the first person in 1916 to reach a nominal fortune of $1 billion. Margaret Sanger opens the first U.S. birth control clinic, a forerunner of Planned Parenthood. And in World War I, Paris is bombed by German Zeppelins. And tanks are first used in the battlefield in France. They don't even know what to call them. They look like just big metal objects that might be floating in water if they were used in a naval sense. So they call them tanks or landships. They're initially effective. The Chicago Cubs play their first game at Wegman Park, modern-day Wrigley Field, defeating the Cincinnati Reds 7-6 in 11 innings. Harvey Washington Wiley, the head of the USDA Bureau of Chemistry, orders the seizure of a Coca-Cola shipment. This becomes a case called 40 Barrels and 20 Kegs of Coca-Cola. That's the name of the Supreme Court case. 40 Barrels and 20 Kegs of Coca-Cola, decided in 1916. It utilized jurisdiction in rem, meaning that it focused on the product rather than targeting the Coca-Cola company. And Coca-Cola responded by voluntarily reducing the caffeine levels and offering to cover legal expenses, leading to a settlement and also showing the power of a regulatory agency. Dinah Shore is born in 1916, so is Eugene McCarthy, so is Walter Cronkite, and so is Gregory Peck. Historian Shelby Foote is born, and so is actor Kirk Douglas. Henry James dies in 1916, so does the writer Jack London, and Henry George, the politician. In San Francisco, California, a bomb explodes on Market Street during a preparedness campaign. It kills 10 and injures 40. They do not know who was responsible for it, but the authorities quickly snatch up 2 labor activists who had been causing trouble. They are later, after years of legal fighting, are released. Aviator Ruth Law sets a new distance record for cross-country flight. She flies 590 miles nonstop from Chicago to New York State. Orville Wright sells Law the plane that she makes the flight in, but he wouldn't train her because he didn't believe that women should fly. I guess just that he should make some money off it. She flies on to New York City the next day. Norman Rockwell's Boy with a Baby Carriage appears in the Saturday Evening Post. A boy, steadfast, moves a baby carriage, but he's a bit embarrassed because younger men dressed in baseball clothes are making fun of him. It's not a significant picture for Norman Rockwell, except for the fact that it's his first Saturday Evening Post cover. These are just some of the events going on as the election year 1916 that we're discussing takes place. But a significant event in Woodrow Wilson's life has already happened. Edith Galt is a wealthy widow in Washington, D.C., and she's not just a widow. And in other words, she didn't just inherit her money and is sitting on it. She isn't just using money from her husband's fortune to drive around Washington, D.C., though she does, and it's very unusual to have a woman driving a car around, but she does. No, Galt actually ran the business. She was running her husband's business, which was failing at the time that he dies. It's a jewelry business. She turns it around, and it's now very successful. She's also friends with Dr. Grayson, the president's physician, who's dating a friend of hers. Carrie Grayson introduces Galt to Wilson, and the two hit it off. From Galt's perspective, what she had heard about Wilson was that he was a machine devoid of emotion, And that's what she thinks. But when she encounters him, when they have some talks, she'll later say, "No, no, no. Wilson is a lonely man, and he keeps his eyes single to the great burdens on him." They start riding around in the car, seeing one another at the White House. They watch the Senators game. "She's a looker," said the White House doorkeeper. "And Wilson's a goner," said his security man. A note Wilson writes to Edith Gault: "The world knows nothing of the heart I have shown you. I cannot face the world with full strength and full zest unless you come into this heart and take possession." This is a lovely note. This should be heartwarming. But the politics. It's less than a year since his first wife died. The dating starts maybe 7 months. And I don't think I have to tell you that maybe it's not that unusual. You know, maybe this doesn't make Woodrow Wilson weird. He might be weird for other reasons. We talked about the lucky number 13 and things like that. But politically, 7 months after the nation poured its heart out for the death of Ellen Wilson, the first lady, they're having a period of courtship and then quickly get married at Woodrow Wilson's suggestion. Woodrow Wilson's cousin, female cousin still in the family, Woodrow Wilson's daughter, Margaret Wilson, will be critical people to selling this process, to convincing the public that this is true love, this is what's good for Wilson, they support this marriage. There's still going to be some eyebrows raised. And I can't tell you, there's no exit polling, you know, for me to tell you what impact this has on the election we're talking about. I can only suggest that it must have had some. We talked about Wilson's summer home, Shadow Lawn. No longer there. There is a structure at Monmouth College in New Jersey. The original Shadow Lawn burnt down in the 1930s. It was rebuilt and is now part of Monmouth College. It originally a teaching college for women in the 50s, now Monmouth College. The college, in recognition of Woodrow Wilson's racist viewpoints and policies, no longer use his name on the property. A cartoonist, and not a favorable cartoonist to Wilson, seizes this issue of Shadow Lawn and shows a picture of the president in cartoon form in front of his house, dodging various shadows on the lawn. And each shadow represents a problem that the incumbent faces. It's a partisan cartoon, but nonetheless, it does sum up well the problems that Wilson is facing in his re-election battle. I mean, Hughes might be making some speeches that feel a little flat, but for Wilson, one shadow is Democratic spending indulgence, and it's shaped like a little money bag. Another is shaped like a little submarine, and it says military threat. Another one is shaped like TR's Rough Rider hat, and it says TR. Another is shaped like a German military hat, and it says German-American vote. Then there's another shaped like a pig. It says pork spending. Then there's just one that says Daniels. It's referring to Josephus Daniels. See, Daniels is an appointment that Woodrow Wilson makes. Woodrow Wilson doesn't have a lot to pull from. Democrats had not been in the White House or nor in cabinet. So he picks a progressive friend from North Carolina, leading progressive forces there as his Navy secretary. Josephus Daniels had not had much contact with the water, as near as we can tell. Certainly no naval experience or boating experience, it seems, for that matter. Yet he's leading the Navy, which in 1913 might have been okay. But now we're in the grip of two European nations at war in the high seas. So Daniels himself is just the butt of jokes, particularly in Republican newspapers. But the final shadow in this cartoon, in front of Shadow Lawn, is the image of a woman. The shadow of a woman is holding a rolling pin, and it says, "Woman's Vote." And that rolling pin is just about aimed at Wilson's cartoon head. Obviously, this cartoonist is not pro-Wilson, but he is representing these threats that the incumbent is facing that aren't boding well for his reelection. The women's vote seems to be one of them. And if we remember in last episode, we talked about Charles Evans Hughes, as evasive as he might be on a lot of issues, was not so on the woman's suffrage issue. In fact, he steps out ahead of his party and says it's not good enough for the states to decide whether women can vote or not. I want there to be a national constitutional amendment. Congress should pass it, and the states should ratify it. In doing so, Hughes nullifies the threat of a third party, a national women's party, which was threatening to hurt both Wilson and Hughes. The other thing is, he fires a missile at Wilson, because now Wilson has to respond. And both of these candidates have states in their column that aren't too keen on women voting, but it's probably a little more for Wilson in that he has the support of the Solid South, where this is not a very happy issue. Now, I mean, let's put our cards on the table. Why? And I think that for those who support Wilson, giving women the vote might lead to civil rights votes after that. Either that the women themselves will be more receptive to civil rights laws, or that the precedent will lead to more aggressive voting laws where they're restraining the vote in the South of African Americans. That's it. Wilson has to do something on this issue. He cannot let it sit. And so he goes from El Barron, not too far down, to Atlantic City, New Jersey, where there's a women's convention, and he's going to make a speech. And like so many things in this election, people aren't really sure what the impact of that speech is.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1915, in Gwin versus the United States, a Supreme Court justice had found that Oklahoma's grandfather clause, restricting voting, disenfranchising black voters, violated the 15th Amendment. It also will affect a number of southern states, even though they'll find ways around it. The same Supreme Court justice had delivered the opinion of the court on a case concerning Oklahoma's separate but equal law on railroad facilities. He wrote, "Equality of treatment of persons traveling under like conditions cannot be refused." It's the beginning of a stand that could contradict Plessy versus Ferguson that was not enough in that particular decision. This justice, surprise, surprise, is Charles Evans Hughes. I say to you that I stand for anything, for equal and exact justice to all. I stand for the maintenance of the rights of all of those citizens, regardless of race or color. The one word that I love above all others is the word justice. That's Charles Evans Hughes at Fisk University. And because of these statements, the hopes of African Americans in some quarters, not all, are on this Republican nominee. Look what he said. There is this group that's very excited about Charles Evans Hughes at this time. You take the African American Appeal newspaper in Minneapolis, and they make that quote. They have it in big letters. I say to you that if I stand for anything, it's equal and exact justice for all. Now, some of this should not surprise us. Just as the Solid South, which we should always understand is both machine-run and also unfair because of restricted voting of African Americans. If they're solidly for Democrats, Republicans are, as Frederick Douglass said, the Republican Party is the ship and everything else is the sea. African Americans are generally solidly Republican. And in appearance, it's going to be the same in this election. Of 300 African American newspapers, for instance, only three of them will support Woodrow Wilson's reelection. We talked about in the last episode how downright rude, at least for modern standards, Wilson was to African Americans who came pleading for votes. And in 1916, he makes no particular appeal. The best you get is Joseph Tumulty, his secretary, who's aware of the potential for the African American vote, who does say that, look, the president is trying to do things, but he's being stopped. And the most you'll get out of Wilson is that he's trying to create opportunity for all, trying to improve the economy, provide more jobs, make things fairer for all, which will reach every group. He declines to make any particular statement to African Americans. And they, boy, do they notice. So there's a lot of hope when the NAACP sends a letter to Charles Evans Hughes, asking him for his positions on a set of issues. And then that hope declines when the letter is unanswered. And its editor, William Du Bois, says African Americans should vote for Alan Benson, the socialist candidate, or they should vote for no one at all. Now, Du Bois is not the only African American, right? And he doesn't speak for everyone, though he is a significant leader. Hughes-friendly Republicans will take out ads in the NAACP crisis newspaper so that Hughes has some support there in any case. John E. Milholland, the first treasurer of the NAACP, assures African Americans that Hughes's attitude is right on every question of civil rights. And Elizabeth Freeman, who is a white English-born suffragist and progressive who nonetheless has great credibility in the community because she had investigated the lynching of Jesse Washington for the NAACP, she joins the Hughesettes, a group of prominent women campaigning by train for the Republican ticket across the West. Freeman will attack Wilson on his lack of appointments, doing nothing about lynchings, doing nothing about civil rights. The African-American activist William Monroe Trotter, who had supported Wilson in 1912, and that was a big move, we're going to get into that in a second, appears with Charles Evans Hughes. Doesn't endorse him, but appears with him. And Hughes does indeed make one speech to a black audience in Nashville, Tennessee, where he says, "I stand for the maintenance of the rights of all American citizens, regardless of race or color." There is a Republican National Committee, Colored Advisory Committee, the CAC, formed in October, headquartered in New York. largely composed of Republican stalwarts. Fred Moore, the editor and publisher of the New York Age. Charles Cottrill, collector of internal revenue for Hawaii. William Lewis, the first black assistant attorney general appointed by Taft. Harry Cummings, the first black Baltimore councilman. And others. They are part of this committee supporting Hughes. So he has some establishment African-American support. Here's the New York Age. The nomination of Charles Evans Hughes means victory for the Republican Party. In Mr. Hughes, the Republican Party has a candidate of the highest order. Some feel that what the race needs in a president is merely the absence of prejudice, but sympathetic interest. And they have been wondering if Charles Evans Hughes has won, will develop this sort of interest. In our opinion, fears upon this point are needless. They run a front-page cartoon showing Hughes standing on a ground labeled Republicanism and holding a paper, "You may have explicit confidence in me, for I believe in equal opportunity for all." And there's no doubt that largely African Americans in 1916 are supporting Hughes. I mean, he's going to win more of their votes than Wilson. We don't have exit polls. I'm going to talk about that in a bit. There's no exit polls. We don't know. He's going to get more votes than Wilson in this group. It's just, I think any scholar of history will agree. But there's some interesting undercurrents going on. We talked about Du Bois. That's one. There's some little breaks. And just to go back to Du Bois, because he's such a powerful speaker at this time, he just calls Hughes doggedly dumb on our problems. It's like he's a smart man. He knows we've brought up these issues to his attention. He just doesn't want to speak about them. How is he going to be his president? He just won't support him. Ralph Waldo Tyler, a newspaper man and a Republican politician from Ohio, says, "While governor of New York, he did not make one solitary colored appointment, big or little. In fact, he justified it by suggesting he would not appoint any man because he was a particular color or Irish or German or whatnot." And Tyler said, "Usually that high idealistic stand results in the utter ignoring of us." There's, you know, you see in that's 1916. You see in that a lot of the discussion today. If someone says to in the realm of politics today, if someone says, "Look, I don't see color," that's essentially what Hughes is saying here. Boy, you're not going to get a good reception necessarily, I believe, from an African-American audience on that point. Of course, we are talking about 1916, so things are very different. But you see these grumbles. Black nationalist and longtime Republican John Edward Bruce wrote, "Hughes is neither a Lincoln, a McKinley, nor a Roosevelt in his attitude towards us, and was hardly a man to enthuse over." And the Republican Convention of 1916 was the beginning of the end for our involvement in Republican politics. Now, what is Bruce talking about there? And it gets to a whole change that's occurring right as this election happens. What a crazy time 1916 is, because not only are so many different things going on, a European war, huge domestic changes, increasingly there's a movement that African-American newspapers describe in a not so good way because they don't like it as the Lily White movement within the Republican Party in the South. And you have the states of Louisiana, North Carolina, Arkansas, Alabama, where for so many years the Republican voters in these states were African American since the Reconstruction. By the time you get to the turn of the century, white Republicans in these states are like, you know, we really want to try to win these states. We actually want our presidential candidate to be competitive in the South and not just cede it to the Democrats. And we're not going to do it, unfortunately, with the African American vote alone. So in each of these states, they replace African Americans on the delegate ticket, where normally they would be, with white Republicans. Angered by this, African American Republicans in each of these states have competitive slates. and they go to the Chicago convention in 1916, that same Chicago convention that's going to nominate Hughes, and they go before the Credentials Committee. And in each case, the white Republican ticket wins. They see the writing on the wall. And this is an obscure thing of politics, but it's very important for who has power within a party, and it is not missed. I don't want to say that it's as important as the resegregation of the federal government under Wilson, because one is a government and the other one's within a party structure, but that would be an interesting question to pose to African-American editors at that time. And I think in their reaction, in some cases, it's as disturbing, because it's going to, if there's white delegates instead of African-American delegates, that means you have less power in picking who the Republican president's going to be. And that means you have less political power within the party. And they see it. The NAACP crisis. The African-American voter enters the present campaign with no enthusiasm. They are forced to vote for the Republican candidate, Mr. Hughes, and they find there is little there that is attractive. We want to say a last word to the leaders of the party. If anyone thinks that the Republicans have 500,000 votes in their pocket, they have some thinking to do. No intelligent Negro, this is Du Bois speaking, not me, can vote for Woodrow Wilson, but he can vote Alan Benson, or he can stay home on election day. Unless Mr. Hughes satisfies him by some statement more specific than the Nashville speech or speeches of 10 years ago. You have two movements within the African-American vote at this time, and one is called Fortunism and the other is called Harrisonism. And they're named after proponents of the theory, basically. And the way to look at the Fortunism is also, it's also been called the Mugwump movement. And the Mugwumps were groups of Republicans, if we remember, in 1884, who voted for Grover Cleveland, the Democrat, because on corruption, Grover Cleveland was better. We'd rather have an honest Democrat than a corrupt Republican. And so this Mugwump movement, this is Fortunism in African-American voting at this time. And there you see that some group of African-Americans decide that Woodrow Wilson is a better candidate to put their fortunes in. He's happy to receive these votes. He makes a few statements, particularly about equal justice and being fair. Doesn't make specific commitments, but he makes some statements to get this vote. And some group of African-American voters, Du Bois is one of them that supports Woodrow Wilson, because while he's a Southerner, he's a progressive. Look at the way politics are going. He might be elected anyway. And the Fortunism is the idea that African Americans should stop just bolting themselves to the Republican Party and instead use their vote strategically. Sometimes vote Democrat, sometimes vote Republican, sometimes not vote at all. Whatever works. Vote for Republicans at a national level, vote for Democrats at a state level. Whatever works. That's Fortunism. Harrisonism is exactly the opposite. It's a more militant use of the vote, and that African Americans should vote for their own third party, for their own African American candidates and party. Neither one of these movements really wins. Eventually, it's going to take a long time for the African American vote to get settled in 20th century politics, really, when you think about it. Still not settled in like when John Kennedy's running. So neither of them are going to really, just because they're a theory, going to win out, but they're coming up at this time when Woodrow Wilson's seeking re-election. And so it's an important view to state. You have hundreds of African-American newspapers with positive things to say about Republicans and Hughes, some of them not endorsing anyone at all, a few endorsing Benson the Socialist. And you have maybe three papers they think that actually are African-Americans endorsing Woodrow Wilson. Why is any of that happening? Well, it's very few, but you have, for instance, a black Tammany Hall movement. They're going to be working in the state of New York for Wilson. You have Rufus Perry, a significant Brooklyn African-American lawyer and activist. He's been a fighter for years. His father was a reverend and a political fighter as well. And he heads up the Hannibal Democratic Club. And he's going to write a letter supporting Wilson that's going to be in African-American publications all across the country, which they run as kind of like, hey, we're showing both sides here. Perry's point is going to be that Wilson has made some appointments. Now, people are going to counter to Perry, like, where are these appointments? Because they can only really find two appointments of African-Americans that Woodrow Wilson has made. And there's been about 10 that were made by Republicans that either because of Wilson's prejudice or his cabinet's prejudice or because of the simple political situation that those Republicans aren't in power anymore, 10 of African-Americans have been removed from positions. But, you know, accentuate the positive when you're writing a political speech, and Perry wants to concentrate on the two appointments that Wilson did make. What else? Why else would any African-American endorse Wilson in this race? Again, it's not much, but there are some local areas. Kansas City, where that local club supports Wilson. Tulsa, Oklahoma, because the government of the city of Tulsa is Republican, the African-Americans there are Democrat. So they come out for Woodrow Wilson. There is also a rally in Buffalo. As far as we know, this is the only physical rally of African-Americans actually appearing in public to support Woodrow Wilson. It's small, and it's derided in African-American newspapers as, what are you doing? He's sinning against you, and you are just encouraging him to sin against you again. Another thing that should be stated is that while we talk a lot in this election about Roosevelt is out there, and it's so true that Roosevelt is out there making these incredibly belligerent statements about how wimpy Woodrow Wilson is and about how America should stand up for its rights. So Democrats start using Roosevelt against Hughes. But you also have to remember that at least in the African-American context, they're using people like Tillman, Senator Tillman of South Carolina, virulent, although he's a progressive, he's also a racist, Ben Tillman. So they use that in some cases against Wilson, substituting Tillman for Wilson in a lot of the speeches. In other words, they'll have a speech of Hughes about Hughes's education policy versus Tillman's, not Wilson. You're seeing that same substitution of, we're going to run against the guy we want to run against. Though you may not all believe it, I would a great deal rather hear somebody else speak than speak myself. But I should feel that I was admitting a duty if I did not address you tonight. Woodrow Wilson goes to Atlantic City, and he makes that speech to the women's conference there. Does he want to make the speech? We know that Edith Galt, his new wife, is there by his side. That's a good-looking image for him. But she does not support the suffragist cause, and she doesn't want him to make this speech. But it has to be made. It's reported on nationally, this issue. Everything he says to this group right now in Atlantic City will be part of the campaign. He knows it. And he hails it in an interesting way. I mean, the only way to describe this speech from a modern point of view is a kind of gaslighting. I don't think they would think that then, but because his approach is, you guys don't need me. You're already succeeding with your suffragist movement. Why are you bothering the President of the United States with this? I mean, that's kind of what he's saying. The astonishing thing about the movement to which you represent is not that it has grown so slowly, but that it has grown so rapidly. No doubt for those of you who have been a long time in the struggle, like your honored president, it seems a long and arduous path that has been trodden. But when you think of the accumulating force of this movement in recent decades, you must agree with me that it is one of the astonishing tides in modern history. So, in a sense, what he's doing is placing himself in the back seat, in the background. He's just a bystander watching the suffragist movement go by. He's not like the president that could sign bills or anything. He continues. I get a little impatient sometimes about the discussion of the channels and the methods by which this movement is to prevail. It's not merely because women are discontented. It's because women have seen visions of duty. And that is something that we not only cannot resist, but if we be true Americans, we do not wish to resist. We feel the tide. We rejoice in the strength of it. And we shall not quarrel in the long run as to the method of it. In other words, he's saying, rah, rah, boo, rah. You keep going, women. I'm not going to do a thing about it, but I'm also not going to stand in your way. But the whole practice and art of government consists not in moving individuals, but in moving masses. It is all very well to run ahead and beckon, but after all, you've got to wait for the body to follow. I have not come to ask you to be patient, because you have been. I have come to congratulate you. But there was a force behind you that will, beyond any peradventure, be triumphant. And you can afford a little while to wait. Newton Baker, I think, makes the best description of the Atlantic City speech, which is, with art, with rhetorical expression, Wilson held on to the same position he had had before. And that is, he wants the states to decide. Charles Evans Hughes has advanced his position to where he's supporting a constitutional amendment. Wilson does not decide in Atlantic City to join this. But maybe, because at least he's saying, I'm not going to stand in your way as president, it's helpful. Now, there's a famous moment that occurs. And it's still a question as to whether it's too much has been made of it or whether it's decisive. 4 p.m., August 21st, 1916. The Virginia Hotel, a very elegant hotel in Long Beach, California, not far from Los Angeles. The governor of the state of California, Hiram Johnson, who is a progressive who had run as Theodore Roosevelt's vice presidential candidate on the Blue Moose ticket in 1912, is now running for Senate. And the entire establishment, everybody that was in the convention in Chicago leading, everybody that supported Taft, they're against Johnson. The governor of California enters this hotel about 4 p.m. and he sees that there's a big commotion. He's like, what's going on here? It's not for me, so something must be going on. And he's informed, yes, the presidential candidate, Charles Evans Hughes, is going to have an event here. Oh, well, I wasn't informed. And he goes up to his room, closes the door, and stays in his room for a while. Charles Evans Hughes, who has just motored up from Los Angeles, has a reception, does the handshake, makes his speech talking about that protective tariff and Republican unity and all of that, and leaves. It is only later that Hughes realizes, when he gets back to Los Angeles, that this whole event had occurred, that the governor was there, and he didn't say hello, he didn't invite him to the reception or anything like that. He immediately tries to make amends. He sends his campaign chief to meet with Johnson. He invites him to preside over the very next speech he's going to make in California. He suggests an exchange of courteous telegrams. Johnson refuses. In a telegram to Hughes' campaign manager, Johnson says, "The men surrounding Mr. Hughes in California and who have been in charge of this tour are much more interested in my defeat than Mr. Hughes' election."
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. To follow trends, track financial situations, follow gains and losses, check out the Yahoo Finance podcast. Every day, we'll give you a quick overview of the latest market and financial news that you need to know, You'll be able to hear about the biggest headlines in the business world in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. It's perfect to listen to while you make another cup of coffee or work out a new budget. Check it out now. Listen to Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
Hughes says, for his part, I have been very desirous of meeting the governor of California, and had I known that he was in Long Beach when I was there, I would have seized the opportunity to greet him. This is still debated years later, how much this was a contributing factor, because as we're going to find out, California is the decisive state in this election. There's another event going on at the same time while Hughes is campaigning, Wilson is staying in Chatillon. Because in June, four major brotherhoods of railroad workers who have been pushing for an 8-hour workday have finally been fed up with the railroad employers and give them notice they're going on strike in September if something doesn't change. The railroads refuse. Now, I want to keep something in mind. The 8-hour workday is not meaning that everybody's going to stop work at 8 hours. It's just that that's what we use to calculate a day. So if you work 8 hours today, it has everything to do with the events we're talking about. They want the standard of calculation of what a day is to be 8 hours. In August, Wilson asks Congress to pass a law that will have the federal government state that the official calculation of a day is 8 hours. Workers should be paid pro rata for anything more than that, and there will be fines and penalties, and Congress has the power to enforce. The reason that Wilson ostensibly intervenes in the railroad strike is that it's going to affect preparedness. Cities, he says to Congress, will be cut off from their food supplies. A congressman in Georgia, Edmondson, leads the effort, and the bill is passed. Wilson holds it at his desk, then goes out to Chatillon and makes his acceptance speech. Boasting is always an empty business, which pleases nobody but the boaster, and I have no disposition to boast of what the Democratic Party has accomplished. He does not mention 8 hours. There can be no violation of good taste in calling attention to the manner in which these promises have been carried out, in adverting to the interesting fact that many of the things accomplished were what the opposition party had again and again promised to do. The working man of America have been given a veritable emancipation by the legal recognition of a man's labor as part of his life, and not a mere marketable commodity. And a key point he is going to talk about is something called the Clayton Act. And he doesn't mention it by name. He says, by exempting labor organizations from processes of the courts, which treated their members like fractional parts of mobs and not like accessible and responsible individuals. By making adequate provision for compensation for industrial accidents. By providing suitable machinery for mediation and conciliation in industrial disputes. We've also affected the emancipation of the children of the country by releasing them from hurtful labor. So he doesn't say anything about 8 hours, but what you're seeing is the first American president to appeal to labor, and he's showing what he's done. He has acknowledged in federal legislation the presence of labor, and he has eliminated the ability of the courts to call a labor union a monopoly, because that's what they were doing. They were treating labor unions in the same way they would treat Rockefeller. Oh, you're going to hog up the labor resources and try to bargain collectively. No, you can't do that. That's the same as a monopoly. The Clayton Act recognizes, as Wilson is saying here, that somebody's labor is connected to who they are. It's not just a business. So he's also going to strengthen his Department of Labor. When he gets back to Washington, he's going to sign the Edmondson bill. This requires an 8-hour work week. It also forces Hughes on the defensive. The Republican Party are a pro-business party, and they see in this, wait, you didn't even allow arbitration. You didn't allow the railroads to sit down with the leaders and arbitrate the differences with a neutral arbitrator. You're denying businessmen their rights. So there is a contrast now between Hughes and Wilson on this issue that Wilson has thrown at him, in that Republicans are going to mourn the loss of business arbitration rights, and Wilson and the Democrats are going to celebrate labor. And according to the accounts of various labor officials, Hughes now sinks to third in terms of their voters. I mean, you don't have the same type of polling that you have, but you have the comments of labor officials where Wilson is one, the socialist Benson is now two, and Hughes slips to three. Maybe time has erased these small gains. Like, it doesn't seem like much because you're taken for granted now. In terms of the election of 1916, I think this goes a long way to explaining things. Something else happens. William Jennings Bryan gets on a train. Campaign takes Mr. Bryan through 19 states in 8 weeks, during which time he makes 4 or 5 speeches a day. So all of the power of William Jennings Bryan, which has been put to work in 1896 and 1900, and then 1908, is applied for Wilson in 1916. The San Jose Mercury Herald says, "No one had larger or more appreciative audiences in this campaign than Bryan, and the one issue that appealed to his tender sensibilities was that of peace." Only one of the states covered by Bryan would go Republican in the 1916 election. As someone said of him, his mood is the mood of the West. And the campaign goes back and forth. There's more speeches. Hughes now has this issue of arbitration, which shows that the president now is using arbitrary powers that he doesn't have. He's just deciding the outcome of a businessman's agreement with their workers, making them win without going to arbitration. But you also have Theodore Roosevelt and the war. Roosevelt says about Wilson, "The time for the ostrich policy, the time for the head-in-hole policy in America is past." And he urges that America take a decisive role in the war. Now, for some, the only way to interpret this is that we should have entered the war already. And this is where Wilson counterattacks. So he's not making speeches every day, but he can go out to Shadow Lawn, crowd there, and make speeches from the columns. Here it is. On September 30th, he says, "The certain prospect of the success of the Republican Party is that we shall be drawn in one form or another to the embroilments of the European War." Wilson has done it now. He wasn't for that slogan, "He kept us out of war," but now he's joined the chorus and said a vote for the Republicans is a vote for war. As if to say, "I agree," Roosevelt in a second speech says, "President Wilson, by his policy of tame submission to insult and injury from all he feared, has invited the murder of our men, our women, our children, by German submarines at sea." Democrats take this quote from Roosevelt and send it all over the West and Midwest. Roosevelt doesn't stop. "The statement, 'he kept us out of war,' is utterly misleading. It's the phrase of a coward. It's distorted into a promise that under no circumstances we could go to war. And if I had been president," Roosevelt says, "when the Lusitania was sunk, I would have seized every German vessel and turned in American waters." And this goes all the way to the last moments of the campaign. He does not stop. October 7th, a German U-boat with a black Maltese cross was off Newport, Rhode Island. And It's friendly to American ships. It even allows local boats to come see it and engages in conversation with locals. But when it sees a merchant ship designated for Britain that's under its requirements, it sinks it right off the American coast. In one case, the U.S. Navy saves the passengers who have been sunk. And the British complain about Wilson's activities here. And this is sets up impossible situations when you have two belligerents at war. One has submarines that can go under the water. And I want to talk about those submarines for a second because they create new and different types of opportunities. You have some American merchants talking about, what if we started a submarine merchant division? And this way we could get supplies to Germany under the merchant blockade. Not a lot of talk. Some talk about that in 1915, not so much in 1916. There's also talk that Germany could be building through its submarines a station in the middle of the Atlantic. You know, it's going around the British Navy. The British Navy had been the most feared in the world. And for the first time, its own ships are targets. And so this creates something. Eventually, Wilson does complain to the German ambassador and U-boat 53 is removed, but it seems to anger Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt says, finally, "There should be shadows now at Shadow Lawn, the shadows of the men, women, and children who have risen from the graves in foreign lands, the shadows of the helpless whom Mr. Wilson did not dare protect." And as he makes this speech, Roosevelt tosses his manuscript aside. He's so angry. "The shadows of babies gasping pitifully as they sink under the waves. The shadow of women outraged and slain by bandits. Those are the shadows proper for Shadow Lawn." Hughes is going to have to make a few statements. He's complaining to people that they make it seem like if I get elected, Roosevelt, you know, I'm just going to let Roosevelt start a war. And he makes a few statements, distancing himself slightly from Roosevelt. Never quite enough. Both sides have their partisans out, Bryan and Roosevelt, and it's close. You're starting to get the sense, Hughes even says, for the first time, if we lose, it's because of this war issue. First starting to get a sense that his campaign thinks that, you know, this could go either way. Wilson, we now know, sets up a secret plan whereby his Secretary of State would resign in the event that he lost this election and then nominate Charles Evans Hughes, if he wins the election, for Secretary of State so everybody can resign, he and Vice President Marshall, and get by the order of succession back in those days when the Speaker of House was not involved in 1916, you'd have Charles Evans Hughes as president early because Wilson made it clear he did not want to be a lame duck president for 5 months during this crisis. Behind the scenes, the journalist Walter Lippmann is a supporter of Wilson, but he's telling folks, not because he's a peace president, because we know that we're going to be going into war, and he'll be a better war president. Two events happen politically, and one is that Republicans win in Maine. Maine, at this time, has its election weeks before the national vote. And it goes for Hughes and the Republicans. This has been a feature of politics through the 19th century into the early 20th, where Maine is a little bit early and it's used as a bellwether. That's a good sign. The other thing that happens is, in the New Jersey primary, a candidate that Wilson has backed against Senator Martin, who Wilson does not like, in the Democratic primary, Wilson's candidate loses, Martin wins. These are both taken as blows to Wilson's campaign and signs that he's most likely going to lose. A prominent Irish-American author and an activist who is on the German side in terms of World War I writes Wilson a letter asking him, like, why won't he answer the desires of Irish-American activists and take a stand against what Britain's doing on the high seas? Wilson doesn't respond to every letter he gets, but he responds to this one. "Given that you are connected with disloyal people, I would rather not have your vote." Of course, this letter is published. Wilson's aide, Colonel House, thinks this is the greatest thing you've ever done. This is better than any speech you could make at Shadow Lawn. Not everyone agrees. because this is a direct slap against the Irish-American vote, still very important for the state of New York. Wilson is damaged by two mini scandals. One is that Wilson's Secretary of War, Newton Baker, apparently makes a ridiculous comment comparing the Mexican Revolutionary soldiers to our own American Revolutionary soldiers. Sure, the Mexican soldiers might steal. This was an allegation made by the newspapers, but so did our American Revolutionary soldiers. They stole and plundered as they fought battles across the American continent. What? This is printed in the newspapers. Charles Evans Hughes is like, this, I could not even imagine such a comment coming from this nation's Secretary of War. They already don't like Baker on the Republican side because he's a pacifist and he's Wilson's Secretary of War. This is the old days of newspaper dumb. There's no videotape. Newton Baker denies that he ever made this comment to the reporter, and the newspaper was not a friendly one to the Wilson administration. There's a bit of a bubble over it, but the scandal does die. Then there's a second one involving an allegation from a prominent Republican, Henry Cabot Lodge, that Wilson issued two statements to the Germans after the Lusitania sinking. One was the statement defending American rights, condemning the attack, that was in public. And then there was a private note. Lodge has a source. It's Wilson's original Secretary of War, the Secretary of War before Baker. This gets a lot of play in newspapers. And because of whose it's coming from, you know, of course he's a Republican, but he's also a prominent senator. Wilson has to simply say that the allegations made by Senator Lodge are untrue. This burns Lodge up because he knows it's true. And it is true that there were two notes sent. However, the sentiments expressed are not exactly the way that Lodge described it. There wasn't a secret letter, you know, offering peace to the Germans. And you get to Election Day. And it's all on the table. And the results are that Hughes wins New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Illinois, big states. Wilson wins all of those southern states a Democrat typically would, including Texas, including Virginia. He wins border states, Tennessee and Kentucky. Hughes had a little hope for, but he also wins Ohio. Now, this is a big win. Ohio had not gone Democrat since the Civil War. James Cox is a popular figure. He's running for governor. In Ohio in 1912, Eugene Debs, the socialist, gets 90,000 votes. That's going to shrink down to just 36,000 for the less effective candidate, Allen Benson, in 1916. If you take a look at Cuyahoga County in Ohio, this is where Cleveland's located. So let's look at a couple of elections. Let's first of all look at 1908. This is where Taft is running against Bryan. It's a Republican win. So it kind of gives you a base idea in a normal election. And Taft overwhelmingly beats Bryan here, 56,000 to 39,000 in this fairly industrial county where Cleveland's located, Cuyahoga County. You fast forward to 1912. Now Wilson wins, and it's largely because there's a three-way split. So in Cuyahoga County, Wilson's going to win with 43,000 votes. Now, that wouldn't have been enough to win except that Taft and Roosevelt, two ostensible Republicans, were running against each other and had a combined vote of about 48,000 votes. So if Taft and Roosevelt were combined, they beat Wilson by 5,000. But Wilson wins because it's a plurality. Socialists get about 10,000 votes in Cuyahoga County in the 1912 election. Let's flash forward to 1916. And again, going to Cuyahoga, where Cleveland is located. Wilson wins with 71,533 votes. This is 30,000 votes more than he got in the 1912 election here. Hughes gets 51,000 votes, suggesting that he did a little better. Certainly better than Taft, and even a little better than Roosevelt, but not enough to reclaim that total combined vote between those two 1912 ostensible Republican candidates. The socialists get just 5,600 votes. This suggests that Wilson, this very industrial county, is pulling from both the socialists, maybe some of Taft voters, and definitely some of the progressive Roosevelt voters, to add about 30,000 to his vote total from when he first ran. Wilson also wins California, and he wins Texas. He wins Utah. Of all the suffrage states, Hughes wins just one of them. In California, it's going to come down to 3,700 votes. In 1912, when Wilson wins the presidency, California does not vote for him. He has to win with other states because California, and again, he has Theodore Roosevelt wins California. He's got Hiram Johnson as his vice presidential candidate, very popular figure in California. But it's not that big of a difference. It's 283,610 for Roosevelt, 283,436 for Woodrow Wilson. So he almost wins on the plurality there. Taft is not even on the ballot in California. Hiram Johnson was so mad at him, he got him pushed off. So it's Eugene Debs there that is the third choice. 79,000, almost 80,000 votes in California, the 1912 election. Now we flash forward to 1916, and what do we get? Wilson wins with 466,289 votes. Charles Evans Hughes, 462,516. Whereas in 1912, they got 80,000 votes. The socialists under Allen Benson get 42,898 votes. So some group of socialists did not vote for the Socialist Party that they had voted for in 1912 when Eugene Debs was running. Now, did they all go to Woodrow Wilson? Probably not. Some might have went to Hughes, but it appears that most did. They trade the two major cities in California. Hughes wins Los Angeles. At this time, it's starting to grow. In 1916, you're starting to see that budding Hollywood. It's in some ways under the control from a business perspective of Otis, the publisher of the Los Angeles Times, a strong conservative anti-union man. But there's also a strong labor movement there opposed to Otis. It is not a good thing that for those people that Hughes is aligned with Otis. In any case, the endorsement of the Los Angeles Times obviously helps. Hughes gets a majority there. Wilson counters that by winning San Francisco and getting almost as large a majority there. He wins more counties in California and narrowly beats Hughes. I think the first thing to say, when an election is this close, when it's 3,700 votes, you know, on any given Tuesday, Wilson could have lost this election and Hughes could have won. So even examining, like, how did Wilson pull it off? I think you equally have to ask, how did he almost lose it? Because let's examine something else. Here are just a few economic statistics about 1916. America's bulwark, crops, have reached their record mark. The nation's principal farm crops this year are worth about $5.5 million, over half a million dollars more than in 1914. Clearances. The week ending December 4th, 1915, checks for $4.9 billion passed through the country's clearinghouses. The largest amount ever handed in 1 week's time. Gold. Mr. Robert Woolley, director of the Mint, goes on record with the statement that the United States now has 1/4 of all the coined gold, the world standard value, a phenomenal condition. The home market. The freight car shortage points an unmistakable finger to the enormous increase in the demand of the home market as well as shipments to the war countries. Retail sales. The biggest Christmas business in history is the cheering message from the retail shops. Postal receipts. The Postmaster General reports, postal receipts contain evidence of healthy and well-distributed prosperity in the country. Wilson has the economy. And that's important for an incumbent. And despite some claims that it's a false economy, there's actually some evidence right there that it's more than just shipments to Europe, although that's certainly helpful. Most incumbents win election in history. We know that. About 75% of the time, the incumbent wins. Not every time. Wilson's positions domestically and on foreign policy were largely the popular ones. They are probably 60% positions, we might say, in today's like polling. Don't immediately jump into the European crisis and enact certain reforms that made the Gilded Age go away. So he's got all these advantages as an incumbent. So the real question to ask is, why was it so darn close? And part of it is, Wilson comes from a minority party. The Democratic Party at the time that we're talking about really is in that position. Only had the White House, besides Wilson's one term, there were two non-consecutive terms from Grover Cleveland, who in many ways was a Republican-Democratic alliance candidate. You only have those three presidencies, and you have to go all the way back to Buchanan before the Civil War to find another Democratic president. So Democrats just don't win the White House at this time. In most states, the Republican Party at this time are just better and more motivated, unless we're talking about the South. But how can you not look at some of Wilson's own actions and say that he contributed to how close it was? One is, although he reached out a bit in 1912 to certain African-American leaders, and in 1916, he shuts that down. It's not like he doesn't have any meetings, but the meetings do not go well. He doesn't make any significant effort to reach out to black voters. In failing to reach out to African-Americans, he denied himself access to that vote, which at this time is not enamored with Hughes. With the exception of Somerset County and Maryland, each county in the nation with a 35% black population or more showed less support for the GOP nominee in 1916 than it had in 1908. No pre-election or exit polls were conducted of the black vote in 1916, very little data to show how people specifically cast their ballots. Of course, it seems likely, if a bit strong, to say that the black vote went almost solidly to Hughes. Republicans certainly won the black vote, but that's almost trivial. The real story of the black vote in 1916 was diminishing enthusiasm, which can be seen at a look of the votes of counties with significant black populations. This is what Du Bois says in his memoirs. Black voters were disappointed in President Wilson and bitter at the Democrats. On the other hand, a new demand for labor had come, and a wave of war-born economic prosperity was sweeping over black folk. It's not that there was a wave of support for Woodrow Wilson. There seemed to be a lack of enthusiasm for the Republican candidate as well. You go to the woman's vote, and you would think that with the Republicans being slightly better on the suffrage issue and Wilson just holding to his position, that there wouldn't be the vote there. But Wilson gets most of the suffrage states. If you look at the voting in Chicago, where they actually recorded women's votes versus men, Wilson loses the Chicago women's vote, but only by 5,000 votes, 65,000 cast. And the Republicans are doing better than that broadly in the state of Illinois. So the thesis is there is that, A, not everyone voted just on the suffrage issue alone. And perhaps in Atlantic City, Wilson had done enough damage control. And then the issue of peace was more important for women than even their own voting. And you're also, let us not forget, the people that are voting in the election of 1916 do have the vote granted from their state. And so perhaps the urgency of that cause for the rest of the nation when they're already voting is a little less to be the only issue you vote on. So I think you see a similar pattern with German Americans. Hughes made the best appeal to them, likely got a majority of their votes. More than a few were likely willing to select the candidate that was more likely to see the country maintain neutrality or be at peace. And Roosevelt's statements probably hurt. Hughes couldn't unload with majorities among these groups, the German Americans, African Americans, and women's groups, because there are some compelling reasons to vote the other way for these groups as well. The Irish-American vote probably kept it close and ensured that Hughes would win New York if it wasn't already clear. Which really sets up the Electoral College potentially for Hughes. And again, I go, any given Tuesday could have won the election. But finally, I must go to that labor vote. And you have really the first president committed to accepting labor as an organized force, not just making a few comments about the American working man, but accepting them on their terms, which is unionized, organized labor and changing law to accommodate labor for the first time. And those votes proved critical for Wilson. Yeah, there's a lot of questions about 1916, but I think what 1916 answers, it's one more piece of evidence that it seems like incumbent presidents win close ties. The most recent examples, you know, it's 2004. Newton Baker, Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of War, said, you know, the president had the power to act, to change the situation on the ground. And that's almost always true. Another observation, which I made back in 2012, and I recorded the episode called Why 1916 Matters before that 2012 election was decided. And I was interested in a trend that no president, okay, had won re-election while losing electoral votes ever before. And it seemed like Obama was headed that way. So it seemed like a danger signal for Obama's re-election. But there was one exception, and that was Woodrow Wilson, 1916. So he had obtained 435 electoral votes in 1912 and just 277 in 1916. The next president to do that is Barack Obama, 365 electoral votes in 2008. Then after I recorded that episode, 332 in 2012. I think it demonstrates the what an incumbent president must do to win re-election, have a compelling message, take some actions, damp down third-party candidates. That was critical in 1916. Larger socialist vote, and Wilson would have lost. Of course, have compelling domestic and foreign policy. Those are the lessons of 1916. We'll see how much they apply today. I want to thank you for listening. The website is www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. You know, if you take a moment, maybe re-listen to the three episodes, I will probably be taking some time, as I first of all have some business obligations to take care of, but also I'm working on the Zachary Taylor cast, and I really just have to get that one done. And since that is a good, it's one that both talks about a president and also deals with the election of 1848, and this is an election year, it'll be a nice one to launch possibly in the summer. So I'll be working on that hard. If you don't hear from me a while, that's the reason. Go back and listen to the back episodes. We've got plenty of them. www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com.